From WPVM LP in Asheville, this is the Dirty Spoon Radio Hour. I'm Lexi Harvey.
And I'm Jonathan Ammons, and this is Bad Bad Hats.
Down your
Dirty Spoon Radio Hour is made possible by our underwriter, The Marketplace Restaurant. Serving Asheville for over 40 years, The Marketplace is Asheville's original farm-to-table restaurant. The Marketplace strives to bring you the best of what our region has to offer, farmed by our neighbors. For more information on our underwriters or to support us yourself by subscribing to our Patreon, visit dirty-spoon.com.
Back in 2021, the Journal of Environmental Psychology published a study finding that 40% of American children under the age of 8 thought hot dogs, bacon, and chicken nuggets came from plants. Particularly surprising since chicken nuggets even have the word chicken in the name. The study went on to suggest several reasons for this disconnect. Less families live on or around farms these days. Parents of the children often shelter kids from the gory details of where their food comes from. But also, less people are out gathering their own foods. When writer Ryan Odenak was growing up in Mississippi, she experienced something fewer and fewer kids get to experience these days: fishing for their regular fish fry with her mother and grandmother.
Mama stands over the stove, one hand resting on the shelf of her wide hip, the other holding a metal spatula. Corn oil bubbles in the cast iron skillet she tends. She's frying the fish we caught earlier in the afternoon. Maybe I shouldn't say we. Mama and her mother, my mamaw, did most of the catching. In this memory, I'm elementary school age. It's not one specific day, but many fishing days that run together. The ponds and lakes where we fish are quiet places with no one else around. They belong to folks who have given us permission to be there. Maybe a client of Daddy's he had tried to sell life insurance to, or an old friend of Mama's she had run into at the grocery store. Jackson wasn't a big city back then, so it didn't take long to get out into the country. Maybe going fishing felt like home to Mama and Mamaw. They both grew up on farms in the hill country of Mississippi, 2 hours north. Maybe it felt that way for Daddy, too. He grew up on a farm in Ohio. Our cane fishing poles right along the outside of our plump Plymouth. Whoever sits by a window is implored to hold on to the poles for fear that Daddy's barely good enough rope tie will come loose. As soon as Daddy turns the engine off, I scramble over the top of Mamaw and toddler sister Melinda, who sits on her lap, to get out the door. I'm too impatient to wait for Mamaw to twist her heavy load around to get herself out. I want to be the first one to get a pole. My younger brother Bubba is right behind me, jumping two-footed onto the ground. We run around to the other side of the car, grabbing at the cane poles Daddy has freed. My older sister Cass takes her time getting out and stands there waiting. Mama passes baby sister Kathleen to her from the center of the front seat, then pulls herself out, straightening her dress as she stands up so the buttons face front. Charging to the water, my brother and I drop our poles on the shore and start throwing rocks as far as we can send them flying. He tries to make the stone skip, and I see how high and far I can make them go. Mama lumbers across the bare, parched grass that surrounds the water and yells, "Stop that! You're going to scare all the fish away!" Bubba and I laugh because we know, like she does, that those fish will swim right back up soon as the water goes still, or we toss them a bread ball. Before we can get our poles set up, Mamaw is already tossing her line in the water and getting down to it, a serious look on her face as she squints into the sun bouncing off the water. Like Mama, she always wears a dress. Mamaw keeps a pretty little handkerchief tucked in her bosom, handy for wiping off the sweat that gathers on her forehead and runs down her cheeks in the heat. "Find you a bobber in a bag and get a hook," Mama tells me, drawing me away from the rock throwing and into what we are there for, fish for supper. She shows me how to press the button on top of the round red and white float to expose the clip that keeps it secured about 2 feet up the line. Then, as I thread the stiff, clear line through the eye of the hook, she watches, reminding me, "Honey, make a good knot in it, or you'll lose the hook and the fish, too." Mama's a little squeamish about worms and lots of other things, so Mamaw's the one who teaches me how to thread the long earthworms onto the hook without ending up with the sharp barb in my thumb. She digs the worms from our backyard and carries them in a tin can with a bit of soil. Worms have no face to stare down, so it's easy to sacrifice them. Even when they are securely on the hook, their flopping and squirming don't stop. "That's part of the trick," Mamaw says. "The fish bite when the worms are wiggling." Daddy isn't interested in hunting and fishing. Not like the southern fathers I know who genuinely love it. He never takes a pole for himself, but helps Bubba, his only son, who enjoys fishing more than he does. When my brother is all set up, Daddy lays back on a blanket next to baby sister, who he's in charge of, and opens the newspaper he's brought along. His only hobby is reading, but he won't risk getting one of his precious Book of the Month books dirty. Mama and Mamaw fish with eyes always on the prize, something for supper. They watch their bobbers for any sign of tugging, ready to make the quick jerk of the line necessary to hook the fish nibbling on the worm. "These fish are going to be so good when we get home and fry them up," Mamaw calls out to Mama. On the banks of the peaceful water, with no one else in sight, we stand in a line that starts with Mamaw. We try to keep our fishing lines from getting tangled. "Honey, move down a little," Mom says, as we each relax and sink into our solitary rhythms. Holding my pole loosely, I daydream in the steamy heat. I want to take a swim, but it's not that kind of pond. There are cows in the distance that might be cooling off here later. The water's muddy, and reeds are growing along the shore. I think of the Sunday school story about Moses floating in a basket that his mother hid in the reeds of the Nile River. I wish I had brought my dolly, her blanket, and a little basket so I could float her next to me as I fish. Mama watches my bobber as well as her own. "You got one! You got one!" she calls to me, as excited for my catch as she is for her own. We mainly catch brim. You need a boat for bass, which we don't have. Brim are about the size of an adult's hand, with delicate white flesh and thin skin that crisps up quickly. They have a lot of fine bones, so you have to be very careful eating them, or you end up with a bone in your throat. Mama wouldn't think of putting smelly fish in her nice picnic cooler, so we keep them dangling in the cool water on a fish stringer staked at the bank. It's Mamaw's job to thread the fish onto the long cord. She puts the metal tip of the stringer through the fish's mouth and out the gills. In the water, they flop and swim, staying fresh till we carry them home in an old galvanized bucket that rides on the floorboard between Mamaw's feet. Back at home, Mamaw cleans the fish while standing at the picnic table in the backyard. I watch as she puts her thumb in the fish's open mouth to get a good grip and scrapes off the scales with a spoon. She then runs a sharp knife down its belly, raking the guts onto the table. She cuts the gooey-eyed heads off last. When they're all done, she rinses each fish with the hose. I run the fish inside to Mama while Mamaw cleans up. Mama is all set up to fry. She has a big bowl of Martha White self-rising cornmeal on the counter next to the stove. Mama salts each fish and buries it in the cornmeal one by one. Then, shaking each one, she eases it into the hot oil. I sit down at the little two-seat breakfast table a few feet away from the stove. I like to sit in the chair closest to the back door, so when Mama yells, "Let the cat out!" I can swing the door open without getting up. Everyone else is swirling in and out of the kitchen, like at a train station terminal. No matter where they are heading, they pass through and take a look over Mama's shoulder to check on the supper schedule. She shooes the littlest ones away from her serious business, telling them, "Go in the living room and watch TV with your daddy." Mamaw joins us in the kitchen and stands at the counter grating an onion to make hush puppies. Tears roll down her cheeks. She comes to our house most weekends if we aren't at her house eating with Mama's two brothers, their wives, and my cousins, all boys, who visit from across town and North Mississippi. Mamaw lives alone just a few blocks away, in the little house we all lived in not long ago. It's close enough for me to ride my bicycle over to see her anytime I need some peace and quiet or a big glass of iced tea. I'm named Lucretia after Mamaw, even though neither of us is called by that name. Instead, they call me Creasy, a nickname officially inserted on my birth certificate in quotation marks. Mamaw is called by her middle name, Evelyn, pronounced like the nighttime, Eve-Lynn. Mama, standing there over the stove, is wearing an old dress because she's frying. Her shirtwaist dresses are all alike, purchased from the JCPenney catalog three at a time in bright colors like turquoise and pink. The newest ones, dressed up with matching ear bobs and necklaces, are for church or for going to the grocery store. The not-so-new, but still okay, are worn around the house in case someone drops by to visit. People always do. The oldest dresses, stained and tattered, are for messy cooking like canning or frying. I see new grease stains splattered down Mama's front as the fish pops and sizzles. Mama tells me a story as she pokes at the fish, lifting a corner to make sure it's not getting too brown, a dreamy tone in her voice. I've heard the story before, but I listen anyway, my chin resting on my fist. When I was a kid, there was a creek that ran right through our land. In summertime, brother and I would set hooks on our trot line in the creek as the sun was going down. When Mama says brother, I know she's talking about my Uncle Hal. I know, too, that setting hooks means putting the bait on each one. We'd have the line stretched out between us with those hooks dangling off of it, then ease it into the water. Then the next morning, we would get up early and run barefoot across the field to see what we had caught. Was that at the old home place? I asked, doing my part by showing I am listening. Mama nods and goes on. Those mornings, brother and I would pull in 10 or 12 fish, still flapping. We'd dig the hooks out of their mouths and run back to the house just as fast as our little legs could carry us. Your mamma would meet us at the back door with her sharp knife, and quick as you could say Jack Robinson, she'd have those fish gutted, seasoned, dredged, and in the pan. About the time your granddaddy and his men got to the house for breakfast, the fish would be coming out of the frying pan. Mm-mm-mm. They were so good. They sure was, sister, Mamma chimes in, agreeing with Mama without stopping her work or turning around. Some weekends, we'd drive down the dirt roads of Mama's childhood and stand on the side of the road, peering over a barbed wire fence at the 1,000 acres of land her family lost years ago when her daddy got sick with leukemia. He took a loan on their land to pay for the hospital. When he died, Mamma couldn't pay it back. Mama was 12. In those quiet moments beside the road, I imagine Mama running down the hill towards the creek and coming back to her house with the fish. I feel the coolness of the red loam of the fertile land where Mama grew up. I watch as Mamma beats the grated onion into cornmeal mixed with egg and milk. Finally, she hands the batter to Mama, who is ready to fry the hush puppies. Mama tells me, "Go wash your hands, get up here and help me." Mama demonstrates the size she wants and then keeps a close eye on me to make sure I have done it right. The batter is thick, so it's easy to roll rough little balls and rest them on a plate ready for Mama to drop into the skillet. "Why they call them hush puppies?" I ask. I know the answer, but I want to hear the story. Mamma repeats the two-line story as Mama stays focused on moving the balls around in the pan to keep them from burning. "Cause in the country we fry up the leftover cornbread batter to feed the dogs. We'd throw the little balls out the back door and say, 'Hush, puppies!'" I love that story, and imagine Mamma on the back steps of their country house, surrounded by my granddaddy's hunting dogs that I've seen in pictures. "Arf, arf, arf!" I bark, pretending to be a little dog at Mamma's feet. "Hush, puppy!" Mamma calls back, tossing the first hush puppy out of the pan from hand to hand to cool it before passing it to me. I bark again, calling for another. The last of the frying done, a bowl of homemade coleslaw and some tartar sauce made earlier in the day come out of the refrigerator. We all sit down at the dining room table and Mama delivers a large, chipped platter piled high with fried bream and hush puppies. Daddy folds his hands and bows his head, signaling all of us to do the same. On Sundays, he says the blessing, shaping a long prayer from the events of the week. The other days, he calls on one of us kids to recite the quick version of the blessing we use for everyday meals. "God is great, God is good, let us thank him for our food. Amen." Mama and Mamma sit next to each other, close to the kitchen door so they can jump up and get anything we need. "We did good today, sister, didn't we?" "We sure did," Mama says to Mamma as they both dig into fish, hush puppies, and coleslaw. They eat with the same concentration they had while we stood on the side of the pond. "Mm-mm-mm," is all they both say until they finish eating. I dig in my raised bed tomato garden. A shiny brown earthworm does flips to avoid my trowel. I pick it up and let it slither through my fingers. Mama and Mamma, both long gone, appear in my mind. Fishing lines tossed in a murky pond, wind blowing the tall grass that surrounds it. That afternoon, I stand in front of the fish counter at Whole Foods, admiring the glistening silver branzino. After eating it for many years in restaurants, I realize I like it because it tastes like bream. Later, olive oil sizzles in an old iron skillet as I gently pat cornmeal on both sides of the fish. I confidently ease my catch into the hot pan like Mama taught me. Dining alone, I moan with delight at the fish's delicate flavor and cooked to perfection, crispy skin. Mm-mm-mm. Licking my greasy fingers, I smile, knowing my mama and mamma would be proud of me.
Lee Glass reading Ryan Odenick's story, Two Fishing Women. You can find that story and all of our backstories on our webpage, dirty-spoon.com.
Sing me blues. Won't you sang me the blues. Sing me something my heart can use. Misery loves a symphony.
Where's your face, your pretty face? You get lost in a crowd and you say no one's there to hear you cry out loud. What will you do, Suzette Blue? Where'd you learn to do that so well? Where'd you learn to do that so well? I guess that would be like Cassandra if it's a secret. Why did you show me? But you're far away from the love you used to hold. Don't sit and watch yourself grow. The day is new, Suzette Blue. The day is new, Suzette.
Light on the
The other day, I came home for a quick lunch break during my workday. Peering into the fridge and finding no leftovers that could easily be reheated, I did something that I'd seen my grandmother do 1,000 times. In fact, it's so old hat for me now, I almost forgot I learned it from her. I reached up into the cabinet and grabbed a small can of chunk tuna, dug out a single celery stalk from the fridge, and rooted around for the mayo and mustard to whip up a quick tuna salad and smear on a couple slices of toast. It's one of a dozen kitchen hacks I picked up from her over the years. Simple, cheap ways to turn pantry relics, old veggies, kitchen scraps, or just whatever you have lying around into a satisfying meal. A lot of us are looking for ways to eat cheaper these days, what with the prices of groceries as high or higher than they've ever been. And while times and demand for things do change, certain methods can still prove to be most effective and efficient. And time again, those tend to be the ways your elders did things. Writer Mike Howard did some exploring of his own family cookbook. Here's his story, Hacks from the Holler.
With all the talk of lower gas prices, a full tank of gas still costs me over $100, and I use regular. Even with spring sprung, heating bills have me wearing long johns and sweaters. And the price of groceries has me digging out my Aunt Ruth's transcriptions of great-grandma Sarah Amanda Howard's recipes. My great-grandpa Jacob Howard was a good provider back in the Piney Hills of Bell County, Kentucky. He raised cattle, kept a string or two of horses, supported a couple of families of sharecroppers, and ran a blacksmith shop on the premises. They called it the Piney Woods, but the strands of hickory, black walnut, and willow provided shade, timber, sustenance, pharmaceutical remedies, and the occasional bee tree. Numerous streams and creeks provided fresh water and trout. A low-grade but usable coal could be dug out if you knew where to find it. And if worse came to worse and you had the savvy, ore could be smelted into iron and forged into steel. Sometimes times were good, and sometimes times were tough. When times were good, great-grandma dazzled family, friends, and guests with a fair fit for New Orleans dandies. When times were tough, well, you'd just hardly know it from the variety, quality, and soul-satisfying victuals gracing the table. When Jacob sold beef, he kept the cheaper cuts, and Amanda exercised a gourmand's flair. Liver, kidneys, brain, tongue, heart, and oxtail made for savory and nourishing meals. If meat was scarce, you wouldn't really miss it. Eggs, milk, butter, wheat, rye, and corn took up the slack. Little was wasted. The carefully emptied shells left over from any of her myriad egg dishes were filled with cornstarch pudding or blancmange, and when set, the carefully shelled treats were served up on nests made from strips of colored calf's foot gelatin. A bit of elegance in times of want. After all, she'd say, the eyes have to eat too. And under her tireless ministrations, the eyes feasted. She cracked peach and plum pits, dried the kernels overnight, and used them to flavor pies, pastries, creams, and cakes as ersatz bitter almond. She saved rose petals, rubbed them with a sprinkling of sugar, and soaked them for a day or two before boiling them into jelly with more sugar and lemon juice, if she had any lemons. If times were indeed tough and morale was ebbing a tad bit, she'd make a surefire pick-me-up with milk, still warm from the cow, and sweetened with rose jelly and a shot of whiskey. Just the thing to start the day off right. I priced offal the other day, some of great-grandma's go-to cuts. Oxtails cost $14 a pound. Beef tongue, $6 a pound. A whole tongue cost $22, and even beef liver, when I could find it, priced out at over $7 per pound. Yikes. Back to Sarah Amanda and her silk purses from the Sow's Ears cookbook. Time for something like her bread and beer soup. Take 8 slices of pumpernickel bread, a bottle of dark beer, a cup of water, and a lemon. Cut the pumpernickel into cubes and place in a bowl or saucepan. Add the beer and water. Cover and let it sit in a cool spot for 3 to 4 hours or overnight. At mealtime, heat to a simmer over a medium flame, beating with a fork as it thickens. Grate the lemon into the soup. Add the juice and sweeten with sugar as desired. Plate with a good dollop of cream, fresh or whipped in the center. Food fit for a king.
That was Thomas Worrell Lupton reading Mike Howard's story, Hacks from the Holler. The Dirty Spoon Radio Hour is made possible by our underwriter, the Marketplace Restaurant. Serving Asheville for over 40 years, the Marketplace is Asheville's original farm-to-table restaurant. The Marketplace strives to bring you the best of what our region has to offer, farmed by our neighbors. For more information on our underwriters or to support us yourself by subscribing to our Patreon, visit dirty-spoon.com.
Thank you. You know who you are. Won't you even think of giving up?
The Dirty Spoon Radio Hour is a production of Dirty Spoon Media.
All of the text from our stories is available on our webpage, dirty-spoon.com. There, you can also catch up on past episodes, as well as subscribe to the show and help us keep going through our Patreon. The incredible artwork on that page is by Corinne Pease, Katrin Dosa, Ashley Icomedes, Kelly Manier, Garnet Fisher, Paul Choi, Marianne Pompano, Claire Winkler, and Alex Knighton.
Music in this episode by Bad Bad Hats, St. Vincent, John Cale, Ben Harper, The Hypos, Sam Evian, Michael Now, Leo Sawicken, Bay the Lone, Yule, Fred Again and Brian Eno, Blue Dot Sessions, and Tyler Ramsey. Lexi Harvey is our editor-at-large, sources our stories, and handles our website and marketing.
Jonathan Ammons is our editor-in-chief, handles the music selection, production, recording, audio editing, and writes some of the original music. Tune in next month for more stories, conversations, and music from the people who shape what we consume right here on the Dirty Spoon Radio Hour from WPVM.